And our final speaker for this session will be John Brooks. He's ARS at Mississippi State University, and he'll be speaking to us about bioaerosol release, transport, and fate during land application of manure and biosolid residuals.
Okay, well, as the final speaker, I either have a total of 40 minutes or 50 minutes to talk, so I can take my time, or I'll just keep it short, and maybe I only have 2 or 3 minutes to talk, but we'll get through it quickly. All right, so biosolids. For some of you that do not know what biosolids are, it's the organic solid residual of wastewater treatment plants. So wastewater treatment plants essentially want to remove the water and solid fractions of the wastewater stream. Essentially, you end up with something called raw sludge. That raw sludge is further processed into biosolids, and it's treated to a degree. There are two classes, a Class A and a Class B. Essentially, we're talking about Class B biosolids. These are the ones that are known to and thought of to contain potential pathogens, and we're talking about enteric pathogens for the most part in this case. I won't go through manure much since we've already been going through it probably throughout the entire discussion today. But I will say that manure, one of the interesting facts about manure, though, is that it's got intense variability. There's quite a few different types. Where when we talk about biosolids, pretty much the majority of the municipalities around the U.S. at least have gotten to a point where it's fairly stable. The operation at the treatment plants have gotten to a point where everything is pretty nationalized and standardized. Whereas manure, on the other hand, you have pig effluent there in the far left-hand corner. You've got chicken litter, pig effluent being sprayed via center pivot. And, of course, you have cow manure as well. So there's a lot. And then this doesn't even account for horse manure and sheep manure and various other types of CAFO byproducts that are typically land-applied as well in some situations. So there's a lot of variability when it comes to manure, and hence variability when it comes to the bioaerosol dispersions. When we're looking at the enteric pathogens and indicators associated with these byproducts, the biosolids and the manures, typically our concentrations, and we've got a fairly decent characterization of biosolids, for instance, we typically see in heterotrophic plate count bacteria, which are a generic way of measuring bacteria. We can think of these as general bacteria. You have approximately 10 to the 9, about a billion organisms per gram of biosolids. Coliforms are a little bit less, 10 to the 5, E. coli is less, and so on and so forth. Once you get down to the pathogens, which are at the very bottom here, salmonella, enteric viruses, you're down to less than 10 and less than 1 normally per gram. So very low concentrations for when we're talking about the pathogens. Manure, similar situation as well. The only difference really with manure is that typically you'll see higher concentrations of bacteria than you'll see in biosolids. And this is the simple fact that manure typically is not treated other than the storage function that we typically see on most CAFOs. So bacteria tend to persist in manure at least a little bit longer than they do in Class B biosolids. Viruses, you'll notice there's no viruses up here, and that's to be expected. Manure is not going to have human enteric viruses in it generally. There's a couple of weird instances, but generally it won't be in there. So as far as aerosolized pathogens are concerned, Rob already went through a lot of that, so I'm not going to go through that. Endotoxin, same thing, and he put up a similar picture of this, so I'm not going to go through any of that. But the typical land application operation has really four steps, and it all varies. Some only have 2 steps, some only have 3 steps, but let's say a 4-step operation in which a biosolid or a manure are brought to the site and they're unloaded directly on site. Sometimes, depending on the operation, we're talking about tons and tons unloaded via a dump truck. So that's a step right there, step one, where you can have significant aerosols generated. Okay. Step two, the loading operation. This is typically where you see loading of the biosolids, loading of the manure using a front-end loader and loading it into the hopper or the spreader that's going to be used. So that's another potential source, and we'll see later on that that's going to be one of the main drivers of aerosolization when we talk about these application sites. Finally, or the third step is the application process, the actual application. Of course, you're going to generate aerosols there. And in some instances, we have incorporation where these manures and biosolids are disked into the soil. That's going to create aerosols as well. So just a few pictures. These are biosolids being unloaded in Solano, California. Biosolids being loaded in a front-end loader and into a hopper. Chicken litter in Mississippi. Swine effluent in Mississippi. And you can see this bottom right-hand corner is a design that a colleague of mine had come up with, and that is how to incorporate, or at least how to keep the swine effluent deposited at a low height so as to avoid the intense aerosol generation. And liquid biosolids and biosolids land application. And finally, disking. So all those are all potential aerosolization processes that could be occurring. So we've got quite a few papers out there. When I was at University of Arizona, we did quite a few studies out there, and so you'll see some of my data. There's also been quite a few studies on Class B biosolid aerosols, wastewater aerosols, and raw sludge aerosols, particularly in the early 80s and late 70s. So you'll see an amalgamation of all that data as well. Manure, you're only going to see one study, and Rob showed some of that, the Bowden study. That study, that's really kind of about it as far as the published bioaerosol studies. We've looked at a lot of the emission rates, as many of you have already discussed, but the bioaerosols for manure is really lacking. And that's somewhere that's something that my group at ARS in Mississippi State that we're really starting to focus on and starting to collect data from. So, and Rob is doing it as well out at Idaho. So what you're going to see here are, on the y-axis, you've got concentration of bacteria or viruses per cubic meter of air. It's in a log form, log base 10 scale. On the x-axis, you've got the different operations and typical aerosols concentrations that you're going to see throughout the study and various studies. So these are other studies that have been conducted, like I said earlier. For the most part, they're all from municipal wastewater situations and sludge and biosolids, other than the Bowden studies. The pink and the brown bars represent the Bowden studies. And you can see that, for the most part, the loading operation on the left-hand side is really where we see the majority of the aerosolization taking place. You have an average of approximately a million CFUs per cubic meter of air, going upwards of 100 million CFU per cubic meter of air. So a pretty substantial amount of aerosolization occurring during the loading operation. The application, the slinger, spray irrigation, spray truck, you can see that the numbers are approaching that a million mark. But generally speaking, the loading is where we see the majority of the action. Looking at coliforms, so coliforms, we're talking about E. coli, Citrobacter, Enterobacter, Klebsiella. So we're talking about the organisms that EPA likes to use as far as for tracking of fecal waste. So we're talking about coliforms in that case. We see that the levels are far lower than what we saw previously in the HPCs, and that's a function of the fact that the levels are lower in the actual residual, the waste itself. So we expect to see the lowers level levels lower than what we had in the HPCs. And you can see, even for loading, though, still the concentrations are approximately 10,000 CFUs per cubic meter of air. So still fairly concentrated there. There was the Dowd study. Dowd and Pillai in Texas had detected salmonella, actually, being aerosolized in the loading situation there. And Telsch had detected salmonella aerosolization and spray irrigation of waste as well. But for the most part, you can see that the coliform levels are well below 1,000 CFUs per cubic meter of air. And this is going to be a familiar trend when we start talking from this point on as far as these indicators. E. coli levels, as you would expect, it's part of the coliform group, and it's even more specific, so you're going to have even less numbers there. But still, the loading is where we see the majority of the action. Clostridium perfringens is a spore-forming bacterium, and as you can see, the loading scenario, we still have fairly low numbers at 100 CFU per cubic meter of air, so fairly low, really difficult to detect. And that is, once again, a function of the fact that Clostridium is at a lower level than the coliforms and E. coli in biosolids and manure. So you expect to see lower levels. Pre-application, you'll see very few in the air. So this is a potential for source tracking. We talked about that in Rob's discussion, and that it is a potential for source tracking, and Dowd had actually used that as a potential source tracker as well, and so did Berst at Arizona State. The slinging operation will generate, certainly generate Clostridium perfringens in some cases, and some of the other operations will as well. And it's more of the fact that Clostridium is just a tough, tough guy. That guy can handle a lot of the environmental factors in the aerosolization state. Coliphage. Rob talked a little bit about coliphage. What it is it's a virus that infects bacteria. We use them to basically indicate, or at least to model enteric viruses. It's not a very good indicator in that regard, but still we try to use it. The loading operation is typically where we see the high numbers again, whereas the others don't really come up. We did detect norovirus RNA in some instances from a biosolids application, and so that was a unique situation. And Telsch had detected enteroviruses, or Sorber had detected enteroviruses during a spray irrigation, but really low numbers. We're talking below 10, below 1, very low numbers. Endotoxin. Rob talked a little bit about endotoxin. This is really where I think that the majority, a lot of our science in air and bioaerosol should go is the endotoxin. I think a lot of the complaints that we hear from communities, if it's not regarding odor or anything like that, a lot of the health complaints, I think, have something to do with endotoxin. It's a pretty nebulous molecule, set of molecules that can cause a number of different symptoms. And so if you have someone who's talking about, well, I'm just really tired and fatigued, I'm just not feeling good, well, you know, endotoxin, you could throw it in as well. It could be possibly endotoxin. So this is one of those things. But we see that the loading situation has numbers around 1,000 endotoxin unit per cubic meter of air. That's a lot less than what you saw with some of Rob's data with regard to the dairies. And that's really those dairies, you got the hooves and the generation of the aerosols that way. So, but the fact of the matter is that we certainly see endotoxin during the land application operations. One thing we do see with endotoxin is that, for the most part, endotoxin is not subjected, at least we think it's not subjected to these environmental factors. However, it is subjected to the dilution as the solution to pollution. So it is subjected to dilution. And you see that at 200 meters, the top graph there, at 200 meters, that the endotoxin concentrations do drop down to background levels for the most part. Compared to the source. And that's really going to be an occupational hazard, really, at the source versus public exposures downwind. And we'll talk a little bit about risk in a minute. Now, one thing we do see is that endotoxin is really being generated as a result of the soil that's being aerosolized in some cases. Now, this is for arid environments, not necessarily Mississippi, but arid environments where we see a lot of soil being aerosolized and endotoxin. Certainly a result of the soil. Let's skip that one. And so really, and Rob kind of alluded to this, and that is Gaussian distribution of these aerosols. This is why the numbers are so low, and it's difficult for us to detect these organisms or endotoxin, is because the further away you get, you have this Gaussian distribution of the endotoxins and the bacteria and viruses and whatnot. The further away you get, you have this Gaussian distribution. It's really difficult to be able to detect anything. And this can occur just a mere 100 meters downwind of your site if the wind is right. So it's really difficult to detect some of these organisms. And it's also going to lead into the risk analyses in that we can do risk analyses. We've done some. My group at U of A had done some, and I've done some over at ARS and at Mississippi State. You can take some of these numbers that we know, the manure, the E. coli numbers, the salmonella numbers in manure, and we can model it. We can estimate where it's going to go with regard to the aerosols and what's going to happen with it. And we can really generate some decent risk values. And as we were talking about with Rob, the enteric pathogens, and what we do in that case is Rob was suggesting, we model that a certain percentage of the aerosols are going to be ingested, and that ingestion will create the enteric pathogenesis, in which case you will see the dose response, in which case that's how we get some of our numbers for salmonella, for instance, and listeria. There are some down here, the enteroviruses and adenovirus. These we do know for sure they do cause inhalation risks. And so we can generate risks there. So, for instance, one-time risks for occupationally exposed for enteroviruses, you're looking at a maximum of approximately 3 in 1,000 chance of infection. So that's generally, if you read some of the literature and some of the anecdotal evidence, you'll see that it's pretty accurate with regard to some of the first-time exposures. Now, repeated exposures, you have immunity issues, and of course, you start to reduce that number quite a bit once you have been on the job for a certain amount of time. However, the public situations, we've seen the public exposures. We have a lot of complaints from public oftentimes, and like I said, I think it has to do with endotoxin. And it's really because of the fact that they're generally not exposed to these aerosols all that often, maybe once a year, maybe six times a year at maximum. They're really not exposed to them that often. And so their risks are far below what EPA considers to be the gold standard of 1 in 10,000. These risks are 6 in a million or 6 in 10 million. So we have quite a few low risks when it comes to So additional research, we'll skip this. It's just talking about some of the clone library developments that we've done with some of the aerosolization processes and just showing that, once again, soil is one of the driving aerosolized factors. So to conclude our talk today, what we see is really aerosol collection, as Rob said, is still lacking with regard to bioaerosols. We really still have a hard time collecting some of these bioaerosols and really getting good data off of them. We have large error bars, and that's a problem with some of these studies. Aerosol generation, we know that it's certainly a concern. We know that during the land application operations, it can certainly happen. We know that there can be carriage of these aerosols for long distances. Whether or not the enteric pathogens that are normally in these manures and biosolids, whether that's a concern, we don't really know. Endotoxin, certainly going to be an issue, and I think that that's something we really need to focus some of our efforts on. As far as the pathogenic risks, we do know that they're fairly low for the public, and once again, for the occupationally exposed, we do know that those risks are pretty high. And with that, I will end.
Are there any questions for John?
Yes.
Why do you concern so much about endotoxins? Do you know something about the dose response?
There are dose response models for endotoxin, and like I said, we do know that some of the things that it can cause, for instance, as Rob said, the influenza-like symptoms, some of the situations that you have are chronic bronchitis, asthma, coughing, these sorts of things, just general complaints. Yes, basically, endotoxin is a funny set of molecules. You can have very low concentrations, let's say below 10 endotoxin units per cubic meter of air, so really low, almost background levels. But if that endotoxin came from a Campylobacter jejuni, that endotoxin may be very concentrated and may elicit an immune response in you that is extremely powerful. Whereas if that endotoxin came from Citrobacter, it may not elicit, even at a level that's 100 times more, it may not elicit that immune response. So it's all very variable when it comes to endotoxin. It's a peculiar set of molecules. Yes?
So do you think the deposition of some of these bacteria on, let's say, edible crops could be a possible issue? Like if there are crops being grown fairly close to the emission source, especially if they're not cooked?
Sure. It can certainly be an issue, particularly if, let's say it's a field that's recently been irrigated, and so you have a nice moist environment. If that particular aerosol is traveling, and it travels maybe a 200-meter distance or 300-meter distance, and it somehow has survived and gotten past all the environmental factors that it's facing, and once it hits that moist environment, you have organic matter. Because you have leaf litter, for instance, you might have manure particles still there, you'll have water. You'll have an environment in which some situations, such as maybe E. coli, could possibly propagate. So certainly, it can be an issue. We know that Klebsiella propagates fairly well on cotton plants in that moist bowl. We know that Klebsiella can propagate there. So certainly, we know that some of these organisms can. I would think Salmonella is one of our tougher organisms, and I think that if it could survive the aerosol transport, sure.
So what about the survival part? How close do you
Well, and that depends. That depends on your environment. But minimum, I'd say, it, from what the data that we've seen, minimum of 500 meters, provided that you don't have a constant application of manure. For instance, if it's just like a swine CAFO where there's constant application throughout the summer, and if you only have a 500-meter buffer between you and a spinach field, that could be a problem. However, if it's a one-time application, they do it one day, you know, out of the year, and you have a 500-meter buffer, that's probably going to be okay because you don't have that constant introduction of the organism, and you increase your risk every single time you apply.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Are we 10% that we're missing it? Maybe 59? What's your opinion about the likelihood that we're missing something very significant from public health?
Well, the interesting thing about endotoxin, not only the variability that we discussed a few seconds ago, but endotoxin, we're exposed to endotoxin all the time. Whether you're exposed to it because you live in a very rural community and there's a lot of soil, dirt roads, you'll be exposed to endotoxin and you'll get a fairly high dose. There's data to suggest that the higher the dose is when you're younger, you become more resistant to its effects. So there's data that suggests that. So saying that we're missing a major public health component, I don't know. I think if we were to poll everyone in here and say, are you having some breathing problems today? We'd probably say, yeah, you know what? I'm a little tight up in the chest a little bit, you know, and yeah, my allergies are bad. It's really hard to get a handle on it, and I don't necessarily think we're missing something there, but I do think that some of the complaints that we're seeing could have a lot to do with endotoxin, not the bacterial component as far as exposure to a salmonella or exposure to a SARS virus or exposure to some other organism. I think it has more to do with endotoxin. But then you have the odor issue, and then you have the particulate matter issue, and so there's a lot of issues there at play. And endotoxin uses a lot of the same receptors that ammonia would use. So if you become exposed to ammonia and some of these other compounds that will irritate you, well, then exposure to endotoxin is only going to further irritate you and further facilitate that. So it's a complex issue. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for coming to the session today, and thanks again to all our speakers. They did a great job, even though they were pressed for time. So we appreciate you trying to stay on track, and hopefully we'll have another session like this maybe next year. So thank you.